Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 314, recorded August 28th, 2017, for Monday, September 18th, 2017. William Poundstone. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we sit down with some of the technology field industry's most passionate and interesting people who are really thinking about technology in very different ways and talk to them a little bit about their perspectives on the industry. My name is Jason Howell, and I'm thrilled to be here because honestly, the thesis for the book that I was reading, that I've been reading for a little while now, Head in the Cloud, by William Poundstone, is fascinating. It's a question that I've had many times as I think about this world where we rely on search and we rely on Google to a very specific and deep degree. William Poundstone joins me now, and it's great to have you here today to talk about your book. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah. Good to be with you.
Yeah, you're the author. You're no stranger to writing books. You're the author of, I could count, 14 books. Also, Are You Smart Enough to Work at Google is another notable one that came out a few years ago. And it really seems like your approach, the Carl Sagan biography there as well, your approach on some of your books is very data driven. Where does that come from? What is your background in kind of data and studies?
I studied physics at MIT, so I certainly did have this data driven background, and I think that's kind of informed pretty much everything I've written throughout the years.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. So, talking about Head in the Cloud, essentially what you set out to kind of determine is the idea that, I mean, in this data-driven age, we all rely on Google so much, to such a deep degree. It's like we've got a computer in our pocket at all times. So when it comes to just general basic knowledge, we're less inclined to remember things because we have the ability to search it. I don't know. Explain that a little bit. Explain your thesis for the book.
One of the things I found, I mean, this basically started out with the conversation that we're all having. How important is it to know facts when you can look up facts so easily? And one of the things I found is that this is now a pretty serious subject of research among psychologists and so forth. For instance, there's something known as the Google effect. And they've done studies where they will give people a list of trivia questions that they're supposed to read and kind of remember. And there'll be things like an ostrich's eye is bigger than its brain. So kind of cute little trivia questions like that. But they'll have two groups. They'll tell one group that we want you to type these trivia facts into a computer. And after you do that, we're going to erase them. The other group will be told we're going to type these into a computer, and they're going to be saved. And then afterwards, they ask people basically a quiz on the facts that they've just been dealing with. And what they find is that the people who believe that the facts are going to be erased remember those facts much better than the people who know that they're going to be saved on a computer. And again, this sort of makes sense. I mean, it's telling you that your brain has a way of prioritizing the things it remembers. And obviously, when you know you can always look something up later, it's less important to actually remember that. And they find that's actually the way it works. So this certainly has a lot of implications in the world today because, you know, as you say, we do have that computer in our pocket. And we know in the back of our mind that any fact you could ever want is going to be out there in the cloud. So people do have this tendency to not remember as many facts. And the thing I try to address in the book is, what are the implications of that? Are there reasons to remember facts even when, you know, you can look things up? And what's the best way to really consume information from the internet? So I sort of weave all that together in the book. And it was certainly a lot of fun looking into that.
Oh, I'm sure. And I mean, you detailed, I mean, you did all sorts of studies, all sorts of surveys with large groups of people, very particular pieces of information throughout to kind of illustrate the knowledge gap, I would say, and then correlate that to things like income, success, and draw connections between them. When I think of when I think of kind of what you're talking about here, it really seems like there's a line that's driven between. I mean, we had access to the internet and to computers before we had access to all of this information in our pocket. So was there, do you think that there was a big change like 10 years ago when suddenly smartphones specifically, not just feature phones that we got limited information, but we got the entire internet in our pocket? Was that a big kind of transition point?
Yeah, I mean, talking to these psychologists, they all pretty much agree that the smartphone was the game changer, because it's one thing to know that you can look it up on a desktop somewhere, but you don't have that with you. With the smartphone, I mean, it obviously changed the whole role of bartenders in our society. They used to be the arbiters of sports trivia, of any sort of, you know, trivia fact. And nowadays, everyone pulls out their phone. And, you know, you go to any restaurant, you see people looking at their phones. So really, the smartphone has become an extension of our brain, and it is changing the things that we actually, you know, have on tap mentally.
Yeah, and I think about when I was, you know, when I was in school prior to the smartphone generation, and, you know, looking up facts actually took a lot of effort, right? Like you had to have intention. If you went out to dinner with somebody and you were talking about something very random and a trivia point came up and you didn't know the answer, you had to hold on, you had to bottle that up and remember it and then take that somewhere later and in a very intention-filled sort of way, go and seek it out. And now it's this instinct. It's so common and so easy to do that we don't think twice about it. It's like junk. It's like garbage.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, when you had to remember to do it, usually you didn't, so you didn't end up looking at it. So, I mean, there is a big difference there.
But in that case, in that scenario, if you don't follow through with that and you're not informing yourself of that extra information, whereas now you are, I mean, do you think there's a little bit of a difference there? At least now you're getting that information. You're just getting it in maybe a less, I don't know, less of a way that you're going to retain it.
Yeah, exactly. But I think, again, the Google effect applies. Just knowing in the back of your mind that you can look this stuff up kind of tells your brain, don't bother to remember this.
Yeah.
And for a lot of things, we just aren't memorizing these kind of things.
Yeah. I definitely have experienced that as well, where when you're writing something down with a pen and paper, you know, in some ways, I mean, I've heard plenty of people say you will remember things better if you actually write it down versus typing it in. I can type as fast as I think sometimes. If somebody's giving me information, I can type really fast and put it all in there. How much of that am I actually going to retain? How much of is my brain going to hold onto and turn into valuable information, useful information down the line?
Yeah, it tends to go from your brain through your fingers to the silicon chips, and then it's kind of gone, you know.
Albert Einstein once said, never memorize what you can look up in a book. Do you agree based on your time writing this book?
I totally agree the sentiment. I'm a little skeptical maybe of that quote. One of the things I found is that there's all these bogus, you know, quote.
I wondered if this was...
And Einstein particular. There's something called Churchillian drift. And this is the phenomenon whereby whenever some moderately famous person says something that's clever and memorable, we tend to remember the quote, but then we tend to attribute it to someone who's more famous, like Albert Einstein or Stephen Hawking or Bill Gates. So often if you look at that, or Winston Churchill in Britain particularly, so often if you look at who actually said that first, you'll find it wasn't necessarily Einstein.
It probably wasn't.
But I certainly agree with the sentiment.
It probably wasn't. You're absolutely right. I should have used Google and really come up with the answer. Although I did use Google and it told me Einstein. But I mean, that's critical. That's a large part of what you're writing about here, is that the internet offers an intense amount, an intense number of sources for information. And sometimes we find what we're seeking, and that's good enough. And that sends us down a particular trail.
Not only that, but Daniel Wegner at Harvard, who did the Google Effect survey, also did one where he gave people quizzes, and for half the people, they were told, you can just look up the answers on the internet. And people did and got the right answers. And another half was told that they had to do it based on what they actually had memorized. And what they found was that even when you looked at people who scored the same, the people who had looked up the answers on the internet felt that they were smarter than the people who actually knew the facts. They determined this by asking them afterwards in kind of a quiz, rate yourself on these, you know, various items. And one was, I feel smart. And the people who had looked up stuff felt smart because of that. So I think that's one reason we do get this kind of charge that we're very clever, that we're able to look up stuff on the internet. We kind of feel proud of that in a way that maybe even we don't about actually learning a lot of stuff. So that kind of affects this whole phenomenon, too.
Absolutely. Feels like in this kind of new information age that we're living in, some would call it a disinformation age, but we'll talk about that later, is that we're focusing more on developing our skills around how we find information as opposed to memorizing or retaining information. Is there value there? I mean, it's kind of an element of the modern age that everybody lives in. So we need to know how to do that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, schools are starting to acknowledge that you really have to teach people how to use the internet, how to distinguish a credible source on the internet from not, which is a very subtle thing. But one of the things I argue in the book is that the most important thing you need in order to really leverage the power of the internet is to have, you know, some background of basic factual knowledge. Because if you don't know that, you're in a poor position to judge whether a site is some sort of fake news site, whether it's some sort of scam that's trying to sell you something. So it really does help to know some facts just in terms of being able to look up facts effectively.
Yeah, right. Now, you ran a number of surveys for this book in the U.S. and in Britain, all sorts of topics. To kind of find out who knows what and what that leads to. Just real quick before we kind of dive into some of the details there, what were some of your overarching kind of realizations from a lot of those kind of commonalities between them?
Well, I think, first of all, you're surprised at how little common knowledge there is. I mean, we have this idea that there are certain facts everyone knows, like you're supposed to know the capital of Canada if you live in this hemisphere, but most people do not. You're supposed to know how many justices are on the Supreme Court. Most people do not. I think if you're reading this book, you're in a certain state of shock at what people don't know. But by the same token, I mean, these are people who are functioning very well in society. So it does kind of give you pause, these assumptions we have that you have to know this, that, and the other thing, or that there's some particular canon. I think that really there's less of that now than there ever has been. So that's one of the overriding things. Another thing I kind of wrestled with is, how do you justify knowing anything in today's world? Because you can say, you know, you can look all this stuff up as long as you have graduated from college and can tell that to an employer. What does it really make a difference? And one of the reasons that I found was the one I just mentioned, that is really important in really using the internet, that you do have some basic background knowledge. But I also looked at how various types of knowledge correlate with outcomes, like how happy you say you are, what sort of income you make, how healthy you are. And in a lot of cases, there was a correlation there. So that's one way of justifying knowledge that maybe doesn't refer to the sort of the notion that there are certain canons. But even if there aren't, still there are very practical reasons to feel that you ought to have some baseline knowledge there.
All right. So taking a look at part one, it's really kind of modeled after something called the Dunning-Kruger effect, which, I mean, obviously that's a huge theme that follows throughout the entire book. So I guess spend some time explaining what that is exactly.
Yeah, well, this started in 1995 with a bank robber in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, who robbed two banks in the same day. And in both cases, he went into the bank without any sort of mask, without any way of disguising his appearance. So, of course, this was captured on the video cameras. The police put it on the nightly news. And just hours later, the police were knocking on this guy's door to arrest him. And the first thing he said was, "But I wore the juice." I asked him what he meant by that. And he said that he had rubbed lemon juice on his face to make him invisible to the video cameras. Now, he had a rationale for that. He said that he knew that lemon juice was used for invisible ink. So therefore, if he put it on his face, he would be invisible. And he said he had actually tested this. He had put the juice on his face and then took a picture of himself with a Polaroid camera. And according to him, his face was not in the picture. So the police arrested him. Obviously, he was tried. And he kind of went into the annals of the world's dumbest criminals. He got a lot of coverage that way. Now, one of the people who read about him was a Cornell psychology professor by the name of David Dunning. And, you know, while he thought this was kind of amusing, he also realized that there was really something universal here. Because in a way, we are all like that bank robber. Sometimes we do really stupid things, even though we may be smart in other ways. And he figured, you know, maybe he could do some sort of research into that. So he and a grad student by the name of Justin Kruger started investigating this phenomenon whereby people overestimate the knowledge and capability that they actually have, the expertise that they think they have in a particular field. And what they found was that the people who are the least competent, who know the least, are the least skilled, tend to have very exaggerated opinions of how they would rank relative to other people. Whereas the people who are actually very good in knowledge, skills, and competence have more realistic views. In some cases, they even underestimate how capable they are. And this came to be known as the Dunning-Kruger effect. And they would try it in things like, they tried it in jokes, like everyone thinks they know what's funny. So they would read people two jokes, one of which was not funny, one of which was very funny, and ask them to decide which one is the funnier one. And some people were very good at making this distinction. Some people were really terrible. But the ones who were terrible at it thought that they had a sense of humor and they knew what was funny. They did it with gun enthusiasts. They went to a skeet shoot competition and gave people a quiz based on an NRA quiz on gun safety. And the ones who flunked the quiz thought that they were very good and knowledgeable about gun safety, whereas the ones who did very good on it had a pretty much realistic effect. So they really found that this applies to pretty much everything. And since then, it's almost become an internet meme. They won an Ig Nobel Award. If you Google Dunning-Kruger effect on the internet, you'll see tons of hits, people using it facetiously and seriously. So it really has become a big phenomenon. And it was a big organizing principle in this book, because once you start looking into what people know and don't know and how confident they are that they know something, you really find this all over.
It reminds me of a phrase that I've said many times throughout my life, which is that you don't know what you don't know. And that's that's really kind of at the heart of this, right? Like it's
exactly.
you don't know the depth to which you don't know that. Therefore, why would you know that? And, you know, somebody else looking in from the outside could make a different determination. But because you're so clueless about it, you just don't correct. You have no knowledge to which to correct to.
Yeah, exactly. And the people who are not very good at determining which are the reliable sources on the internet,
right,
they think they're very good at it. So if they look up something and find something, they assume this must be accurate because I'm very good at making that distinction, even though you may not be.
Well, and I mean, part of this also, correct me if I'm wrong, is kind of confirmation bias, right? Like you're finding what you're looking for because there is an answer that matches the thing that you want to find. You are more emboldened, you are more inspired and to think that you are absolutely correct.
Yeah, it's definitely related to that.
And we have some, we know by experience that you can find anything on the internet. You can find anything to confirm whatever, however you believe on the internet if you know the right place to look. Is holding on to the idea of knowledge versus kind of this casual access to knowledge, is that born out of nostalgia? Is a nostalgic sort of thing? Is it a counter reaction to progress? Like you talked a little bit about removing cursive from curricula. Yeah. And I mean, you know, I'm happy to say that my daughters are learning cursive. They're at a school that actually teaches it. So from that perspective, yay, score for my daughters. But I mean, how important are those things in this new digital world? Are they necessary or are they just nostalgia?
Yeah, well, I think there is a big element of nostalgia. And in fact, California is one of the states that has decided that cursive is something that you have to be taught in school. But again, you know, I think in that case, being able to use a keyboard is probably more important than that. But it is a difficult question. How do you decide, you know, we're generating so much new information, and for everything that we're going to teach, we have to decide something else that we used to teach, but we're not going to teach anymore. And people tend to be conservative in a certain way about these things. So no matter what you decide, we're no longer going to teach anymore. You have a lot of people saying that that's very important and we got to keep teaching it. Certainly, there's a big move to teach coding to pretty much everyone. Mm-hmm. But that means we're not going to teach something else. So the big question is, what should that be?
Yeah, time is the only resource that we don't have unlimited amounts of it. And so, yeah, you got to pick your battles. Millennials, obviously, would be, I would say, the first generation to grow up in this informational age, like at its core, and especially, you know, with just constant, you know, from a very young age, constant access to the internet and to information in their pocket. How does their experience and the generations that come after them, how does that differ from our experience where we have the knowledge of information collection before versus after?
Yeah, it's certainly a big change. And you see it in a lot of the surveys I do in the book, that if you compare younger people to older people, I mean, there are big differences in types of things that they know. Certainly, they've always had this experience of being able to look up stuff very simply on a computer as opposed to going to a library or something. So that does make a difference in their priorities and the types of things that they remember. And you also find that, you know, millennials tend to have a very different view of copyright. I talk about that with several people in the books. In term papers, they tend to cut and paste a lot of stuff, right, which, you know, if you're of a certain age is considered, you know, a pretty big sin. But for them, it's not. And we see this phenomenon all the time with all these scandals about some politician or celebrity who has supposedly plagiarized something. And it's usually connected, or at least they point to someone on their staff who obviously is about 25 years old and was just got that off the internet. So there is a very different even ethics there at work. And I think, again, the technology has a lot to do with that. We try to tell ourselves that ethics is timeless, but it does have a lot to do with the technology.
Yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned that about kind of lifting information out of search results and just pasting it in versus my experience growing up, you know, where you were researching out of hardcover you know, books and magazines and everything like that. So if you were going to actually lift word for word, again, there was much intention there. You had to actually look at it and type it word for word and be like, I'm going to go ahead and bring this in entirely. And that feels different than just highlighting a block and being like, this is the information that's necessary right here. Bring it over.
Yeah, exactly. And you can tell yourself, you know, I'll paraphrase it later, but you never get around to doing it.
So. Right. You probably forget that aspect. And you also make the point that millennials are the nation's most educated generation. Define educated generation in this kind of new world, because part of the foundation of that is this instant access to information, right? So, I mean, is that education when some of that comes from just a search on the internet, knowing how to find the information?
Well, that's certainly education of a sort, but what they're actually talking about is, I mean, literally in terms of years of education, Today's millennials have more than the previous generation. So there is a big difference there. But what the educational testing service, that's where I was quoting there, found was that in many, many ways, they knew less than previous generations, even though they've had more years of education. So the question is, what are they actually learning in school? And I think part of it is that they're learning different things, maybe not the things that have been traditionally tested on before. Mm-hmm. A part of that is just learning how to use the internet and so forth. And again, I think people just have different interests. Maybe they're more into video games. And if you're into that, well, you're learning a lot about those video games, but that isn't really an academic subject that you test people on. So I think people are sort of inventing their own areas of expertise, and it gets harder to test them on a particular canon because there aren't really those canons nowadays.
Yeah, because if there's another element that the internet has, it's that you can get hyper niche with your interests and find an audience, find a news source that delivers and caters to that specific niche. Maybe it's not a widespread academic consideration, but it's still there, and you can become an expert on that. That doesn't translate to everything outwards.
Interesting thing. I mean, tech enthusiasts have always been saying that was one of the great things about the internet, that you didn't have to depend on these newspapers or TV nightly news that had to, broadcast to everyone. You could really get a small band of enthusiasts about some particular celebrity or topic or video game and really, learn a lot about that. But what they didn't figure was that, people could become very narrow, knowing an incredible lot about almost nothing. And that used to be the case with maybe, specialists in academia. But now, we're all becoming like that with respect to our favorite celebrities or sports or whatever.
Right. Yes. The Jeopardy. The Jeopardy effect.
Yes.
It's not an actual effect. It's not in here listed, but I'm going to push that forward. Rational ignorance, though, was a part of this section of the book that really resonated me from the perspective that there's so much happening in the world right now that sometimes I don't want to resign myself to not knowing about it anymore. I just want to kind of like close myself off from it and not be so tapped into it. Why is that dangerous to do?
Well, I mean, I think there is a real point to rational ignorance. That's a term from economics. And what they realized was that, to learn stuff takes a certain investment of time, and you only have so much time. And the classic example is just following politics in order to vote. You obviously have to follow politics in order to cast an informed vote. But if you really figure how much time you're spending, following daily politics and what the chance is that your one vote is actually going to swing an election, well, it's pretty small. And from an economist's perspective, it's kind of hard to justify that. So there's always been this question, how do you justify, this type of information? And I go through various ways in the book, but I think a couple of answers are, as I say, you really do need this baseline knowledge to really get along with people, to impress people that you're, a reasonably competent person. You do obviously need it to cast a good vote, even if it's not strictly rational. And you do need it just to use the internet in an important way. So in all those ways, I mean, there isn't a point to rational ignorance, but I don't think the point you should take away from that is that you really don't want to learn anything.
That's true. It's not that I don't want to learn anything. It's that sometimes the internet just gives me too much, and I need to step away for a second and take a breather. And so I think that's what resonated with me about that. Do you think things like, so you spend some time in this part talking about geography, people's relationship with geography and knowledge with geography, like, could that be compared to cursive writing? Is knowledge around geography kind of heading in the same direction as elements like cursive writing becoming less emphasized? And is that a danger?
Well, that's an interesting question. I can say, first of all, that just in the comments I've gotten from readers of this book, the people who are geography buffs are very militant about it. They don't like any sort of, indication that it might not be important. But I do give in the book and actually a very good example of why it's important. There was a study done after Russia had invaded the Ukraine. And at the time, the United States was contemplating whether we should, you know, intervene and send military forces there. So these psychologists did a study where they showed people an unlabeled map of the world. It showed, you know, national boundaries, but didn't label any country. And they asked people to locate the Ukraine on that map. They were essentially supposed to drop a map pin at the point where they thought Ukraine was. And they found that the results were quite literally all over the map, as you'd expect. Mm-hmm. There were people who you know, put the map pin in literally every continent, as well as in the world's oceans. There were people who couldn't even tell which were the oceans and which were the land on this map. But the kind of chilling thing that they found was that there was an incredible correlation between how accurate people's guesses were and whether they wanted the U.S. to intervene in the Ukraine. The people who had no clue where the Ukraine was were most likely to think that we should send forces there, which is kind of a scary thought when you consider that, you know, there is a reason why war rooms have maps, because maps are pretty important in determining whether a country is strategically important and even in determining whether an intervention would make any sense, would be really costly or whatever. So I think that perfectly encapsulates this whole idea that you can even take a subject like geography that sounds very dull, and you might think, oh, I'm never going to need that. But yet it does affect people's, you know, or at least there's a correlation, let me say that, between that and people's political opinions. So in that sense, you feel that maybe it is pretty good that we do teach kids geography, because, you know, you can't Google a point of view. You have to have some sort of background knowledge that informs how you react to the news.
Okay, so the second part is really where kind of some of the connections are made between some of the studies that you performed and the, I don't know, like the lack of knowledge that people have and how that ties into their performance in life, be it success, income, all that kind of stuff. Before we kind of dive into some of the details there, explain a little bit your methodology, how you set up these studies to get all this data.
Yeah, these were all national surveys where you collected a lot of demographic information like age, education, gender, and so forth. And you tried to look at how knowledge correlated with various other things like household income, personal income, how they responded to questions about whether they're in good health or poor health, whether they're happy or not happy, or so forth. So I looked at a lot of these correlations. And again, the first thing to say, as everyone knows, is that, you know, correlation does not prove causation. But there were an awful lot of these very significant correlations, and they existed even when you controlled for things like formal education and so forth, or age. So what I'm saying is that I found in many cases people who are better at what you might call trivia knowledge earn significantly higher incomes, both individual and household. And again, this was highly significant, and it was a big effect. Like, you would have $40,000 a year household income for someone who scored really poor on a quiz versus $80,000 for someone who scored very well. And this applied even to things that you wouldn't think would you know, have any relevance to performance on the job, like performance on a sports trivia quiz. Now, for one thing, sports trivia is not something they teach you in school usually. So it had very little correlation with, you know, how many years of education you had. But it did have a big, you know, correlation with income. And I tried to figure out why would that be even. Now, one thing that came to mind, there is this big gender gap in income. So, and, you know, you tend to think that women know less about sports on average. So I looked at that. But even when you factored out gender, you still found this big difference. Whatever gender you were, people who knew more about sports tended to have a much bigger income. And you found this with many other types of trivia knowledge. Now, I think the takeaway there is that some people just retain knowledge, are just interested in the world, are interested in people around them and tend to listen to what they talk about. So if it's any sort of general knowledge, people who do absorb that tend to also have a lot of other capabilities, and that tends to translate into higher income, usually better health, and various other things. So in that sense, I think there was kind of an interesting message there, and it wasn't normally in terms of this idea of a canon where you had to say this is the right way to this is the things that you have to know and nothing else really matters. Because sports trivia, again, is something that you think of as being very non-essential, and yet it did have this big effect.
That's fascinating. And actually, there was someone in the chat room that was asking about sports trivia, because I think in some ways, it's a specialized knowledge base. I mean, a lot of people are very obsessive about their sports trivia. But so what you're saying is, based on the studies that you did, if people knew a lot of seemingly unimportant in the grand scheme of things information about sports trivia, it actually translated into, like, when compared to their level of success, let's say their income level and everything, that was higher if they knew that. Of course, again, pointing back to correlation doesn't necessarily mean cause or lead to causation, but that was the result of your findings.
Yeah, exactly. But I would say it's up to a degree. This was basically easy or kind of medium sports trivia. Questions like, how many players are there on a soccer team? If you ask really hard stuff, I got some trivia questions from websites that were really for hardcore fans. With them, the effect was much less or non-existent. So it's kind of the things that you would learn if you just listen to what people are talking about at the water cooler. But if you just tune out that sort of thing, then on average, the people tended to have lower income.
Yeah, the water cooler now is the phone. Yet again, they're just looking at their phone instead of standing at the water cooler. Now, you created a 10-question quiz to predict income based on knowledge. Is this part of the sports trivia, or was that separated from that? And what did you find there?
I did quite a few of them, both general trivia and basically almost all of the things I tested in the book. I did look at how that correlated. But again, it tended to be the more general things that you would learn by paying attention, as opposed to something very specialized. For instance, what's interesting is that I found that there was really no correlation between being able to spell difficult words and how much income you made. And I got a lot of reaction from that, too, because for one thing, I have some friends who are editors and who are very, you know, upset about that sort of thing. But yeah, in that case, there really wasn't this sort of correlation. And I think, again, it's partly the water cooler idea. You're not going to learn difficult points of grammar by listening to what people are talking about the water cooler.
Yeah.
But just by keeping your ears open, you can learn a lot about more general things.
So this, you know, a lot of this has to do with success, income level. What about happiness? How does this information translate into the happiness of the person who's answering?
There was less of a correlation there. There was some, but it was generally weaker than income. And of course, it's a well-known fact there is a correlation between income and reported happiness, at least up to, let's say, upper middle class levels. So I suspect that's really what you're seeing here. People who know more tend to have higher income, and because of that, they tend to report themselves happier.
Yeah, yeah. So I have kids. They're in school. They're learning a lot of things. But I'm always kind of like evaluating the educational system to understand how effective it is. And time again throughout the book, you point to these examples that show that even though students take classes to learn things, they're learning finance, they're learning geography, history, English, all those things. In some ways, they're no better answering many of these questions than those who hadn't taken those courses. What does that say about the kind of the modern educational system as it stands? Is it behind the times? What are they missing?
Well, I suspect it's not just the modern system. I mean, when I went to high school, I got straight A's in French, but I remember almost nothing of it now.
Right.
There's an example in the book. There was, as you'd expect, a very strong correlation between how well you score on financial literacy quizzes and, you know, your income. which is what you'd imagine. And there is this big controversy now, shouldn't we be teaching financial literacy in schools? And a lot of states do, a lot of states don't. But there have been studies showing that if you actually look at those students and then follow them up, 10 years later, the ones who scored very well in that financial literacy class really are no better off than the ones who flunked it. Because it's something where I suspect you just learn it for the test and then you kind of forget it. So I think we're kind of dealing with that in any sort of education, but it's not really a modern thing. Again, it's easier to teach something when it's relevant to people. And obviously teaching kids how to use the internet effectively is something that's going to be relevant all their life. So hopefully that is something that, they will be able to retain.
And it's something that they're practicing always. If you're teaching them how to use the internet, they have tons of practice. They're inspired because that's where their digital life is lived. And so they're using it. You teach them something like finance. Yeah, that's going to come in really handy as they get older. But right now, they're doing very little probably to practice that on a regular basis, even though it's super important.
Yeah, exactly. So you don't have the relevance there.
Yeah, yeah. Do you also think that it's just simply too easy to find information for students? Like we were talking about a little bit earlier, there was a little bit more intention prior to the internet as far as researching information. Now it's, you do a search, you find what you need, you bring it over, copy and paste in many cases like we were talking about, and then you move on. I mean, on one hand, the internet is very empowering in that regard, access to the world's information. But is it just too easy? And that's bad for education.
Well, again, that's the Google effect, that you don't retain stuff because you know in the back of your mind that that it's something that you can always look up. And in fact, I mentioned a study in the book where they compared American teenagers to people around the world. And they basically found that Americans are now near the bottom of countries. They score less in general knowledge than people in Brazil, Japan, China, and so forth. And they suspect, they haven't proved, but they suspect a big part of that is because American teenagers are much more likely to have a cell phone. So they just understand that they're never actually going to be without a way of looking up this knowledge. And for that reason, they don't tend to retain it.
Yeah, and you also talk about the difficulty of these questions. What can you tell us about the connection between how difficult these questions are to the income level? It almost seemed like you were saying the easier the question that people knew, the more income level you could associate that with.
Yeah, what I basically found is that you want to be a generalist. You want to have this very broad background knowledge, because that's useful in many different ways. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't be a specialist, too. You basically have to in today's world. But the types of surveys I did in the book were basically general knowledge one way or another. So I wasn't asking people about coding or brain surgery or anything like that. Obviously, if you know a lot about brain surgery, you're probably making really good income. But I was basically more focused on the general stuff.
All right, so part three. This is where you really kind of take some time to offer ways in which we can simplify our norms, or at least deal with the norms of the digital age. And the question that I had kind of off the top, are we saying that we should be dumbing things down in the process? Because you spend a little bit of time talking about symbols and making things more clear, whereas as in kind of the previous generation or the previous sense, things would make sense. Now things aren't making as much sense to the digital native. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, although the whole book shows, as some would say, people are really kind of stupid in certain ways, I think in many cases you have to blame designers of products when they make it basically impossible for most of the public to understand. A good example is, the warning labels on medicine. They say things like avoid alcohol. And if you ask people what they think that means, they say, oh, you can have a drink or two, just don't overdo it. When obviously it means you shouldn't be drinking at all if you're taking this medicine. So in Britain, I mean, they have much better medicine labels. And part of the problem here is that our medicine inserts tend to be legal documents rather than actually medical ones. They have to list every possible, you know, contraindication or warning sign, even if it wasn't proven that there was any connection. So that's why you have these awful commercials of people on the beach, and you know they list every single side effect, which sounds really terrifying. And again, it scares people off medicine and prevents them from taking something that might help them. So in cases like that, or these international symbols you have in airports or on apps, it is really important to do usability studies. You can't assume that everyone knows the same things nowadays, and you really have to, you know, be careful with that. So that's very important. But I also look at the issue of how do you kind of curate your sources of knowledge today? Because, as you say, there is so much information available on the internet. And if you don't have some sort of a strategy for doing that, you're kind of going to be lost.
Yeah, it got me thinking a little bit about kind of like terms of service as just one example. You know, we're so used to and even digital natives are used to this, right? Terms of service are everywhere for everything that we use. Yet nobody ever reads them. I mean, it's got to be intentional to some degree that it's I mean, on one hand, they're doing what they have to do from a legal standpoint to list everything that they possibly can. But on the other hand, like, is that taking advantage of the digital natives kind of, I hate to say declining comprehension, but declining attention to that sort of thing?
Well, I think that's a case of rational ignorance. I mean, if you read every term of service, you wouldn't have any time to do anything else.
So, that's so true.
They probably know what they're doing, but yeah.
Yeah. So right, you know, in this day and age, and especially in the last couple of years, we've come to know terms like post-fact and fake news, and it really seems like a lot of what you're talking about kind of ties into that. What would you say the term post-fact means to you in light of writing this book and how it ties in?
Yeah, well, I think just the idea that facts are things you look up, they're not in your head, and you look up whatever facts you want to look up.
Right.
So, yeah, it sort of is one of the main themes of the book there. But again, it also means that it's important to have this basic survival skill of being able to know when you have a reliable source or not. And the studies say that most people really are not very good at that. And again, the Dunning-Kruger effect, they believe they're good at it, but they're not.
Right. They don't know what they don't know. Do you feel like we're living in a disinformation age? Like, and the internet has enabled that? Is it more than ever, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the internet is really driven by this very quantitative thing that it's very easy to find how many page hits a particular site has. And everything tends to be geared to that, whatever will drive more sites. So you tend to have less analysis that you would have in a newspaper because you had an editor saying, this is what we're supposed to do. Now you can see that those, you know, complex, heady analyses really don't get that many hits, whereas something about a celebrity's cat does. So you tend to get more of that. So it's really a difficult thing. And you really kind of have to choose to opt out of some of that. One of the things I mentioned in the book, which really, in a certain way, has changed my life, I used to have my browser set to open to a window showing Google News, because I figured I'd kill two birds with one stone. If I want to look up something, I could also very quickly glance at the news. This sounded very efficient and sensible. But what you realize is that even if it's good news, I mean, you know, very valid news, it is a demand on your time. And if I'm supposed to be looking up something for work, it's distracting me from that. So it's very easy to change so that you just open to a blank screen. And that's what I do now. And I've probably saved about an hour a day just doing that. And I've had a lot of other people tell me that that's one thing they got out of this book that they really liked.
Absolutely. That resonated pretty hard for me right now because I've identified that in myself for quite a while now, where like I put the kids to bed, I sit down on the couch, and if I even go so far as to open Twitter just to see, because Twitter is less about like following my friends, it's more about like my constant access to what is happening right now, my news feed. And I mean, if I do that, I'm basically saying tonight for the next hour or the next 2 hours, however long it ends up being, I'm devoting to reading about news. And at the end of that, like, how do you feel? How do you feel that time was spent? It could have been spent so many other ways. That resonated pretty strongly with me as well.
Yeah, I kind of go on an information diet. As I say in the book, I do kind of recreational browsing just from noon to 8 o'clock. I don't do it in the morning. And again, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, you want to start off in the morning, right? And recreational browsing can start you off on the wrong foot if you're not careful. And also, you know, part of what you kind of dive into is this aspect of cable news. And you do talk a little bit about kind of the Fox News effect, which we can talk about in a second. But before cable news was a thing, we didn't have access to news as it happens. We survived that transition. You point out that the human brain is very adaptable. What's to say we don't maneuver through the kind of challenges of now fine as well? We're just in the eye, you know, we're just in the thick of it right now, and so it's hard to see outside of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think we are adapting, but, you know, the brain does not evolve very quickly.
Yeah.
So you have to be aware of that and kind of take countermeasures. Again, there is a good discipline in the old idea that you would get the news once a day. As it is now, for any story, you feel you have to check up on it, what's happening, like every hour or so.
Yes.
And that can end up taking an awful lot of time without really making you better informed. So you kind of have to, you know, it's kind of a junk food in terms of mail or in terms of news. So you have to be aware that maybe in some cases, less is more.
Yeah. You know, in some ways, fake news, as the term is kind of unavoidable. What would you say are the big differences between a site like The Onion, and which is, you know, satire, it's humor, right? It's not real, it's fake, but it's humorous, versus sites that are producing fake news without that humor? You call it conceptual prankery. Mm-hmm. What I mean, because the line between those can be blurry depending on how you look at it. I mean, one's funny, one might not be funny, but they're both kind of doing the same thing. It's just one's being taken a little bit more seriously.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Facebook is trying to develop algorithms for tuning out the fake news. But when you get right down to it, first of all, The Onion is sometimes brilliant. It's one of the things people like to share. So you really have to allow people to share satire. But satire is to some extent in the eye of the beholder. Some people think that, you know, a sort of trolling type, very subtle conceptual prank constitutes satire of its own. So I'm not sure, you know, how accurate these algorithms can be. The best thing maybe is if they had some sort of, you know, way of labeling sites saying this is satire or this is, you know, something other than to be taken quite literally. Again, I don't know if the people, probably again, the Dunning-Kruger effect, people would assume, oh, I know what that website is. I don't know, need Facebook to tell me that. So again, I'm not sure how effective it would be, but maybe that would be a direction they should consider.
Yeah, and I know that Facebook has begun to do that in the sense that if they see that an article is fake news or whatever, they flag it as such, then it, obviously it's on the in the eye of the person reading it to either trust or not trust that, because at its core, somebody made that determination. Do you trust the person that made that determination that this is in fact it? I mean, it continues on, right? If you want to believe it or if you want to not disbelieve it, you're empowered based on what you see in front of your eyes.
Yeah,
I'll
exactly.
Tell you about that. What about, let's see here. You talked a little bit about the levels of knowledge for those who were watching cable news. You spent some time kind of zeroing in a little bit on Fox News specifically, I think primarily because the studies that you were doing bore results that encouraged more focus on Fox News. What did you find out there?
Well, there is what's actually known as the Fox News effect. Both my surveys and others, Fairleigh Dickinson, I believe, was the first, basically found that the people who watch Fox News tend to be less informed than almost any other news source. In fact, less informed than people who don't even follow the news, which obviously is a paradox. I mean, even if you don't think much of Fox News, how could it actually make people less informed? And I found a very similar effect in my survey. Now, I think part of it is that any news source has its own audience. And they're of different education levels, different income levels. This is well known to advertisers. And the average Fox News viewer is less educated than the average New York Times viewer. Now, there are other differences in terms of politics, but I think you do have to realize that if there is this fairly substantial difference in education, if you then ask them a trivia quiz, you're going to find this big difference there, which they have done. So that's part of it. But there's also the whole business model of Fox News. Basically, it's for conservatives who felt left out by the mainstream media, who wanted, you know, a news source that was sympathetic to conservative ideology. And it is that. But they've kind of, you know, exaggerated that to the point where they tend to favor the things that that, you know, really get people worked up. Stories of, you know, little guys being victimized by coastal elites or the big government, stories of crazy things that liberals say and do, because they can find very easily that these sorts of news stories tend to be shared the most. So that's what they deliver. Whereas if you have something more like the New York Times, they at least try to have this balanced menu. They're going to have foreign news, even though a lot of people think it's boring. They're going to have cultural news. They're going to have scientific news, all these other things. So for that reason, you tend to get better informed if you read the New York Times, particularly if you do so, you know, fairly methodically. Whereas Fox News is kind of this greatest hits compilation of red meat type stories. So that does make a big difference in what the average viewer retains.
Yeah, there's some folks in the chat room that are wondering, like, okay, but when surveys are put together, sometimes they can be put together to favor a certain result. How is that ensured to not happen here?
Yeah, well, I give in the, you know, the actual questions I was testing, things like locating South Carolina on a map. The people who watched Fox News were worse at that. Saying which political party controls Congress. People who watch Fox News were less likely to know the answer to that. So these were pretty basic questions. Again, I think it partly reflects educational background, the median education of the average Fox News viewer, but also just the fact that, again, they aren't really trying to educate people. They are trying to get stories that really connect with people on an emotional level. And that can be very fulfilling, very engaging, but it's not the best way to learn about what's actually happening in the world.
Right. One thing that caught my eye, you mentioned podcasts in there. You say they are the highest scoring internet news source. That's pretty good to read. Why do you say what drove you to that?
Well, just theorizing. I mean, that's what I found. My theory is that a podcast has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and the average listener sticks to it all the way. That's kind of the way it is with NPR's NewsHour, where a lot of people do stick with it on their morning commute. So you really get all sorts of information, including the stuff you think you want and the stuff you think you don't. Now, if you're a cable news viewer, you've got a remote. And if a story doesn't connect with you, you just flick the channel. So I think there is something to be said for these kind of packaged information sources that do have a beginning, middle, and an end.
Right, right. So finally, I mean, you know, you've spelled out a lot of stuff here. And mind you, we've only scratched the surface of a lot of these studies that you've run and the kind of thinking that through to the end and figuring out what it all means. So I highly recommend folks check out the book Head in the Cloud to get all of the deeper level information here. What are some of the things that we can do as users, as people who live our lives on the internet in the digital age, to help ourselves from, you know, throwing our computers and our phones out the window? Like, how do we help ourselves in this new world?
Well, I'm certainly not proposing that anyone do that. I mean,
sometimes I feel like it, though.
I think you just have to be aware of how much time you spend every day actually on the internet. There are apps that will keep track of that, and it can be very helpful. Like, just as they say, dieters, you should take a picture of everything you eat. And if you look at those pictures, you kind of decide why you have a problem. And I think it is helpful to be a little quantitative about how much time you're spending on the internet, and then ask yourself, am I really getting value from that? And if not, as I go into in the book, I mean, there are things you can do to make sure that you do get a better return on your investment.
Yeah, right, right. In what ways is our obsession with technology actually helping? How is it good?
Well, I think, you know, I'm kind of going into some of the downsides of the internet, but, you know, let's reality check here. The internet is an amazing thing. You can get all sorts of information that you couldn't get any other way. So I'm certainly not against that. I'm just saying, you know, make sure you leverage it and get the best out of it.
Absolutely. All right. Head in the Cloud is the name of the book. William Poundstone has been chatting with us, with me here for the last hour. And it's been a real pleasure talking with you about this book. It was a real eye opener. And I highly recommend folks check it out for themselves, because I think it's completely appropriate. It's completely in touch with where we are at right now. And it asks some very valuable questions as far as how much we rely on the information at our fingertips. There's good. There's also some not so good. You do a really great job spelling that out. So thank you for joining us today, William.
Thank you. It was fun.
All right. Excellent. Author Head in the Cloud. Check it out. I'm Jason Howell. Thanks for checking this show out for the last hour. You can always check out everything that we do with Triangulation. Just go to twit.tv/TRI. That's our show page on the web. You can find all of the past interviews, episodes, lots of fantastic people that we've chatted with over the years. If you want to watch us record live, we record live every Monday, 2 p.m. Eastern, 11 a.m. Pacific, 1800 UTC. And you can tune in, be a part of the chat room, and kind of get involved with the folks that we chat with as well. You're like the third person in the triangulation, me, the interviewer, or the interviewee, and you. So there we go. That's how it works out. Again, I'm Jason Howell. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.